Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Sam, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Progress in the Treatment of Myelodysplastic Syndromes, or MDS. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 290 participants, and you come from all over the United States, and we also have international participants from Canada, Kenya, Korea, Venezuela, and the United Kingdom. So really, you're from all over the world, and it is a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. This program was made possible by a grant from Celgene Corporation, and I really want to thank them for supporting this particular program. Now, you have received materials from Cancer Care, and in those materials is information about the program and the collaborating organizations. Now, there also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you to take a moment and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can tell us the topics that you would like us to offer going forward? Cancer Care offers about 64, 65 teleconferences per year, and so we very much appreciate your feedback in terms of topics. Today's topic is one that many of you have asked us to offer, and so here it is. So we take very seriously your recommendations. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Ruben Mesa. He's Chair, Division of Hematology and Medical Oncology, Professor of Medicine, Mayo Clinic in Arizona. And Dr. Mesa is going to address an overview of myelodysplastic syndromes, current therapies, and the importance of communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Mesa.
Well, great. Well, thank you very much, Carolyn. It's really a great pleasure to be on the teleconference today and also to be with so many wonderful and esteemed colleagues as Dr. Robles, Dr. Jabbour, Dr. Chi. My task today is to give you a little bit of an overview on MDS, kind of discuss therapies, and some comments on communication. We hope with today's webinar to really give you kind of a comprehensive sense of where things stand with MDS, particularly as they relate to you as an individual, and there will be a question and answer session. So first, really, what is MDS? Well, MDS stands for the myelodysplastic syndromes, and that is a term that is really a medical term that, you know, both physicians, patients, you know, and certainly family members and loved ones, you really find confusing. You know, most accurately, myelodysplastic syndromes is really a family of blood diseases. They are bone marrow diseases that fundamentally interfere with how well the bone marrow works. The bone marrow is essentially an assembly line for making the key cells that we need in the blood, the red blood cells that carry oxygen, the white blood cells that fight infection, the platelets that help the blood to clot. Now, most accurately, myelodysplastic syndrome is what we would technically call a chronic leukemia. Now, that term sounds frightening, and don't use it to be frightening, but what that means is that the body, the bone marrow, has something wrong with the cells making the blood. And because of that, there is a risk as a chronic leukemia that the disease can progress to acute leukemia. Now, acute leukemia is a big concern, and patients with myelodysplastic syndrome can progress to acute leukemia. In acute leukemia, it is the same issue but to a much greater degree, where the production of blood counts can really drop to a very significant level. Now, as we judge patients with myelodysplastic syndrome, we try to get a sense of their risk. What is the risk with the disease, and what is the burden that the patient with MDS faces? We look at several issues. The one key one is, one, what are the effect on the blood counts? Are the red blood cell count, are they low? And are they low enough that people feel poorly because the red blood cells are needed to carry oxygen, and a lack of sufficient red blood cells can limit our ability to be active or exercise? Is there a decrease in the number of white blood cells that fight infection? And because of that, do patients have a risk of infections. And finally, the platelets, the key cells for helping the blood to clot. Are these cells low? And if so, are they low enough to a level that give us a risk for the individual facing bleeding? The other key risk is the risk of the disease progressing into that of acute leukemia. And why that difference matters is that in acute leukemia, all of these issues that can arise with MDS become that much more aggressive. Now, as doctors, we use a variety of things about how your disease is affecting you, your blood tests, results from your bone marrow biopsy, and some other genetic tests that are done on the bone marrow to have the best sense of the risk that you have with the disease. Is it a disease that is affecting you severely right now? Is it a disease that has high risk for the future? Or is it a disease that we know about but perhaps is not as big a problem at the moment? So we look at these factors and we try to divide up the possibilities of how and when we should intervene to help you in really, I would say, four different categories. And they vary in terms of risk and reward. And the lowest risk, but the lowest reward, is that of watching the disease. And indeed, there are times we will find individuals who are very early on in the course of this disease. They maybe have a mild drop in a blood count. They don't have many symptoms. For many of these individuals, it might make the most sense to merely watch their disease, in that they may be in that phase of the disease for sometimes an extended period of time. The other end of the spectrum is that of bone marrow transplantation. Bone marrow transplantation is a therapy that can cure myelodysplastic syndrome. That being said, it's a very helpful therapy, but it's an aggressive therapy that in many ways is very time-intensive. It comes with a tremendous amount of medical care. It, in its own way, is somewhat life-altering. And who and when we consider for bone marrow transplantation is a very complex question that's very difficult to generalize, but is typically something that is very specific as discussed between a patient and their physician. Now, because age and increasing age makes bone marrow transplantation less of a viable option, we find that the majority of myelodysplastic syndrome patients really fall somewhere in between these two extremes of nothing and bone marrow transplant. And that is really the group that we're trying to help the disease with medicines, and whether that be approved medicines or experimental medicines. Gail Robos, who is an expert in experimental medicines, will be speaking after me regarding some of the clinical trials. Now, regarding current medicines, we really address it to some degree how the disease is affecting you. And we have agreed somewhat as a national group with the National Comprehensive Cancer Network of guidelines on how to treat myelodysplastic syndrome if we need to in terms of medical treatments. Individuals who we think are lower in the risk spectrum, maybe they only have anemia, maybe we see no concerning features from their bone marrow or others. These individuals, we consider things to try to particularly improve the anemia. Medicines such as lenalidomide have been helpful. It's a pill that can help improve anemia in these individuals, in particular if they have certain genetic changes such as the deletion in the Q part of the fifth chromosome, or deletion 5Q. There are individuals who have benefited from Procrit or Aranesp or other injectable medicines that help support the red blood cell count. As individuals become higher in their risk or are affected more significantly with the disease, there are two injectable medicines that many of you may well be on. One is called azacitidine or Vidaza, the other called decitabine or Dacogen. These are medicines that act on the bone marrow and hope to reawaken some of these silenced genes that are present in our cells. What that means in non-medical speak is that we hope that these medicines help the bone marrow to work better. And we judge the bone marrow working better by seeing whether it helps to improve blood counts, whether it helps to delay progression in people who have more advanced disease, or whether it helps people live longer who have faced the disease. Now, part of the challenge with myelodysplastic syndrome is really communication, both communication with your healthcare team and communication with your friends and family. First, in terms of friends, family, coworkers, loved ones, part of the challenge of having a disease like this is that there is not too much discussion about it in the media. Perhaps that's changed a little bit this last fall with a very famous individual having this particular disease. But that being said, it's still a disease where most are somewhat not sure when you tell them that you have myelodysplastic syndrome what to really make of that. We recognize that that's challenging, and that lack of an automatic sense of what you're going through is challenging. There fortunately are more and more materials out there on YouTube, webinars like this, and printed materials that help particularly frame the disease for those who you love. Now, what about communicating with your healthcare team? Well, communication is key. One, in terms of you really letting them know what you're going through, because we not only want to see what your blood counts look like, but we really want to get a sense of what is the impact on you by having those low blood counts. If you are anemic, is that limiting what you're able to do? Is that causing you fatigue? Or is it something that your body has compensated well for and you really are not finding that you're limited? Have you been having problems with bleeding or bruising? Have you been fighting an infection or have become infected? So these things are really key. The final comment I would make about communication is that, as you'll get the sense from this call, there are many options for the disease, and they are applied at different times. And sometimes the goals and the expectations of therapy can really vary depending upon what we're trying to use. For example, I mentioned the medicine Procrit. We know that the goals of that medicine are pretty much only to improve the red blood cell count. That can be helpful, that can decrease transfusions, that can help people feel better, but we know that that's pretty much all that it's going to do. So it's important from our end to communicate with you exactly what we expect of a therapy, and it's important for you to communicate with us that both what you understand about what you've been recommended, that you ask questions if things really don't seem clear to you, and that you let us know whether those therapies that are chosen are really accomplishing very much what we wish to accomplish. And with that, I'll hand it back to Carolyn and Dr. Robles for the next section, where we'll be talking about new therapies and how we evaluate them.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Nessa, for a very excellent overview of MDS, myelodysplastic syndromes, and really for setting the stage for the whole program. Thank you. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. Gail Robles, and Dr. Robles is Associate Professor of Medicine, Director of Leukemia Program, Weill Medical College of Cornell University, and the New York Presbyterian Hospital. And Dr. Robles is going to address new treatment approaches, the important role of clinical trials, and how clinical trials contribute to your treatment options. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Robles.
Thank you so much, Carolyn, and it's my pleasure to be here. And Ruben, Mesa has made my job much easier by giving a very comprehensive introduction to the disease. So I want to take everybody into the next level of discussion. And the first question is, why do we even need new treatment approaches? And I think this gets quickly to the heart of the problem with myelodysplastic syndrome, which is that none of our currently available therapies is good enough. We have patients who only need to get supported in their hemoglobin to make anemia better, but we have medications that only work for 30 to 40% of patients. We have patients who are much sicker who need to have a stem cell transplant, but stem cell transplant may not be feasible for that patient. So let me break things down a little bit and discuss patients in categories with myelodysplastic syndrome and talk about what the directions might be for new therapies and why we need new therapies. And that will lead me then into a plea to everybody to think about clinical trials, which ultimately are going to get us to the cure for this disease. Many patients go into the doctor's office for a physical exam and end up with an abnormality in a blood count, go for a bone marrow biopsy if they're referred to a hematologist, and may be diagnosed with myelodysplastic syndrome without even having any symptoms at all. This situation brings up an interesting area for discussion, which is, first of all, why did I get this at all? Why do I have this diagnosis? What about my life or my prior treatments for other problems or my genetics in my family made me get this disease? And one of the most important areas for consideration in research and ultimately treatment for MDS is the why did this happen? So many patients who are diagnosed who don't actually necessarily need treatment right away, we still want to try to figure out why the disease happened, what might have been the predisposing features for it, and also, importantly, how do we tell a patient, okay, you're going to be okay for a while not getting treatment, but your neighbor over here with the same diagnosis on paper needs to get treated right away. What are the factors that we can use to predict for patients that it's okay to go forward with treatment versus not go forward with treatment? And also the important question that every patient has, well, okay, you don't want to treat me, but how long am I going to be okay without treatment? So a very important area in of new development in myelodysplastic syndrome is in diagnostics. So for many, many years, all we had were blood smears and bone marrow slides to look at. And we can look at blood cells. We can look at the percentage of so-called blast or early leukemia cells in the bone marrow as evidence of a bone marrow that may be becoming more aggressive over time. But what we really want is to dig deeper than that and to use other pathology information, cytogenetics, molecular genetics, deeper information about the disease to try to give us that precious clock of, is this going to sit around and not do too much to bother you for a while, or is this something that we need to jump in more quickly? And that's an area of very, very much expanding research to the point that I would anticipate that there will be changes coming forward as early as in the next 1 to 2 years of looking for certain tests right up front as patients are diagnosed to try to predict what will happen. Similarly, I think there is a big push to follow in clinical trials so-called lower-risk patients to see what happens to them and to try to characterize and compare their marrows so that we can answer for all of you what the disease is really going to do in the future. That's what patients really want to know when they're told that there isn't any treatment up front. Well, how long is this going to be okay? Now, there are patients who are diagnosed with myelodysplastic syndrome who may have a problem that needs to be dealt with right away. They might have a low blood count, white blood cell count that's resulting in recurrent infections. There may be low red cells that require recurrent transfusions. There might be low platelets, which even if they're not low enough to treat, might make the doctor recommend things like, well, don't drive a motorcycle or don't go to an amusement park or things that might impact the quality of life of a patient, even if the patient isn't feeling anything in particular. The problem is that none of the medications that we have to date work anywhere near perfectly for solving these problems. So the direction of clinical trials is to try to improve the capacity of the so-called growth factor medications to stimulate the bone marrow into being able to make more white cells, red cells, and platelets, and also perhaps to combine or put different medications together to try to optimize the situation. Just as a, for example, the red cell growth factors, 30-40% of patients may have a good response, and to be honest with you, it's usually the patients who have the least amount of need for transfusions who respond the best. So the people who need the support the least are having the best response. So clearly room for investigational therapeutics in the growth factors and also in experimenting with using some of the medications like azacitidine or decitabine, which are commercially approved drugs, to see if using them earlier for patients who may not be may not be as sick yet, but who do have some sort of a low blood count, if we got in earlier with those medications, either in a lower dose or in a different schedule from what's being used currently, might we be able to still solve the problem of low blood counts and prevent things from getting worse over time? And these are areas of clinical trials with the commercially approved drugs as well as combinations of them, both with each other and with novel medications. And there certainly is no point to give lists of letters and numbers of new drugs that can't be gotten commercially yet, but it's very important for me to emphasize the point that the reason to do clinical trials and to look for them is, again, because of the relatively poor response rates with available therapies. When we get into patients who really look either because they have many blast cells or early leukemia cells or because they have adverse molecular or cytogenetic features, there are patients for whom stem cell transplantation is going to be brought up as the only curative therapy, and then there are patients for whom, even if that's true, that stem cell transplant is simply not feasible. For this group, again, clinical trials are needed because transplant has plenty of room for improvement. It is a very difficult procedure that is not particularly suited for older patients who comprise the majority of patients with MDS, so we certainly need work there. And similarly, for all of the patients who can't get a transplant, either because they're physically not able to or because there are problems in identifying a good donor, we obviously need to optimize the medications for those patients to prevent the disease from going forward to acute leukemia. I was speaking with a European colleague recently who said that in his country, patients are afraid when there isn't a clinical trial available. And in our country, that seems to be the opposite sometimes. Patients seem to be frightened off by a clinical trial. The message for myelodysplastic syndrome is that while we are very, very happy for many of the patients who are having good responses with currently available therapies, and it's great news, this is not the majority of patients. We have a lot of you who still need help out there, and if there is a way to at least discuss with your doctor or your clinical care team what might be a possibility for you for a clinical trial, this may both help you directly as well as help us figure out what to do, what we can do better to really get more patients cured of the disease and to improve quality of life without such difficult treatments. And I'm going to turn it back so that we stay on schedule for part three of the program.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Robos, for just an excellent, very robust presentation, lots of information and very informative. So thank you. And I know there'll be questions for you as well during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. Elias Jabbour. And Dr. Jabbour is Assistant Professor, Department of Leukemia, Division of Cancer Medicine, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Jabbour is really going to address supportive care to manage anemia, fatigue, and control infections, tips to manage your symptoms, and really all of your quality of life concerns, or many of them. And it's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Jabbour. Thank you.
Thank you, Carolyn. Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for this opportunity. I want to thank my colleagues for making my job very easy and just very simple. A matter of fact, our patients are referred to us because they have anemia. Anemia is a major concern in this disease. They may progress into acute leukemia, or the disease may transform, or whatever it is, anemia remains the major issue, and they're referred to us because of that. So often, these patients are running blood tests for whatever reason, and they discover they have anemia. So first step, as Dr. Robles mentioned, is really important to identify what is the problem. MDS, it's not breast cancer or lung cancer. Still, we have problems figuring out what's going on. Even among experts, sometimes we disagree on a diagnosis. So it's really, really important to have a correct and appropriate diagnosis in order to design the best treatment for the problem. So expert opinion is really important. Getting the workup is important. And then identifying where we're standing with the disease. Because for a lot of patients, when we see them in our clinic, they come to see us and they're concerned. I was told I have so-and-so and my prognosis is bad. I want to get acute leukemia. It's not true. A lot of patients will spend their life with only anemia or at least what we call them, quote-unquote, the low-risk patients, and they may never require any intervention. So the first step is to know what's going on, what is the diagnosis. Second, staging of this diagnosis, how advanced is my disease, and based on that, we can decide what to do. For example, if we have only anemia and we have no other feature of aggressivity, people may be watch and wait with no intervention. If my hemoglobin is 10 and stable with no change and I am asymptomatic, so then fine, I can watch and wait. Second, whenever we have anemia in these diseases, it's a chronic process, and patient may be asymptomatic for a while, and therefore there's no need to intervene. In opposite, some of the patients that we do see, they are 78, 80 years old, 85. I remind you, this kind of disease affects mainly elderly population. So these patients may have heart problems, coronary artery disease, and other issues, and therefore we need to be more aggressive. So a diagnosis, staging, and then put the things in the context of a patient. Remember, we do treat a disease, we do not treat a disease. Therefore, I have somebody with anemia. First thing is, do we need to intervene? Yes or no? No, we do not. That's fine. So then we can watch and wait and keep the follow-up, regular follow-up, close follow-up. Second, we need to intervene because patient, for example, his hemoglobin is 8.5 and he has a stent placed and he's on medication for his heart, so we need to be more aggressive. How we can handle that? What do we have for the anemia? Well, always from the beginning, we have blood cell transfusion that can be done. So definitely we can give somebody blood. And keep in mind that somebody with a chronic disease, we have to be careful because blood transfusion may decompensate heart issue. Or we can use growth factor support. And I know today in our practice, and especially in private practice, we have a lot of conflict about whether we can give it, we cannot, or be reimbursed. There is a role for growth factors, and they can offer some improvement about 40% of the cases. And that is mainly in subset of patients, for example, with a low erythropoietin level and requiring not much of blood, maybe 2 units every other month or so, or even longer. So growth factors do play a role. So management could be watch and wait, could be growth factors, could be red blood cell transfusions. Now, some issues with MDS come with the autoimmune process that we need to address it with the immune approach. And we have treatment for that. Talk to your doctor. And then finally, when we do the workup for MDS, we look into the chromosomes. As Dr. Ruben Mesa mentioned in the beginning, we can identify certain abnormalities like the chromosome 5 abnormal, where a treatment with lenalidomide can improve the outcome. So diagnosis is very important, and then we decide on a strategy whether we need to treat or not, and if we need to treat, we can go with the red blood cell transfusions, growth factor support, immune therapy, and then immunomodulator as well, the last treatment I mentioned. Now, these patients, when they have anemia, most of them will come with fatigue because the red blood cells are in charge of carrying oxygen to the organs. We don't have it. We don't feel great. And a lot of patients, when they do get blood, they feel, oh, we're feeling much better. Keep in mind, it's a chronic process, and fatigue is part of the symptoms of the anemia that we need to treat that. Now, not everybody comes with fatigue. It's only anemia. Keep in mind, these patients are elderly patients having other medical problems. For example, they can have hypothyroidism that can explain the fatigue. So we need to always look at the whole context in a patient and try to identify causes or reasons why the patient is not doing good. That brings me to something very important. You know, I hear it sometimes in my clinic from patients or their families, he's 80 years old, we're doing okay, why when I bother, do we need to improve the symptoms? Yes, indeed, we need to improve symptoms. Matter of fact, by improving the numbers of the hemoglobin and the anemia, we can improve the whole outcome of a patient. Give you an example, even if we do not improve overall survival in the long run, if I'm 75 years old or 80 years old, having hemoglobin of 10 may help me getting back to my normal life. Maybe go enjoy a golf game with my friends or enjoy the weekends with my grandchildren. So it's really important to take into consideration the improvement of the symptoms and the impact that it can have on the quality of life of a patient. So many times in treating cancer, we think with quality of life, and here, indeed, where the majority can have anemia, the improvement of the anemia and the fatigue can have an impact on the quality of life, and that they can affect the long-term outcome of the patient. Finally, I want to mention infections. You know, when we talk about MDS, we think about stem cell, we think about immune system. Yes, indeed, immune system is weak. It's being affected. You know, patient may have a normal count, and that is fine. May can have a normal white count. But I want to remind you that the normal count, when we see a normal count, the neutrophils are dysfunctional. So that means we need to have a high index of suspicion for infection. Whenever we have a minor problem, like skin abscess, minor thing, talk to your doctor, and we should be more aggressive in starting antibiotics because of the predisposition of having infection, of having a weak immune system. So in that sense, be more aggressive. Call your doctor, your healthcare provider, and discuss with them, and be more aggressive in starting antibiotic. So finally, MDS, again, it's a spectrum of diseases. Most of our patients, they have anemia. We can improve their outcome. We need to make an appropriate diagnosis. Once we have the staging designed, the best treatment strategy that can evolve into different steps, and we have several options going from something available to clinical trials, and all these can improve the well-being of a patient, their symptoms, and the quality of life. Finally, I want to end up with the communication. Talk to your people, to your friends, to your family, to your doctors, to the healthcare providers, because we, with a better communication, we can always come up with a better strategy. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Dr. Jabbour, for really this, your very always meticulous presentation on the importance of the management of all of the side effects and symptoms that everyone has on the call, and to be very aggressive around their care. So I can't ever thank you enough for being so specific about these important issues that everyone on the call really needs to be quite aware of. So thank you. And our next speaker is Maria Chi. And Ms. Chi is she's an oncology social worker, and she is a clinical supervisor at Cancer Care. And Ms. Chi is going to address the free psychosocial support services offered by Cancer Care and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my colleague, Ms. Chi.
Thanks, Carolyn. As a social worker here at Cancer Care, I'd like to briefly talk about the emotional and social impact of cancer and how Cancer Care can help you. When you are first diagnosed with myelodysplastic syndrome, or MDS, it can be an overwhelming experience. You're faced with a series of choices and may not know where to turn. Talking to a Cancer Care social worker can help you get the support that you need. Cancer Care is a staff of licensed master's level oncology social workers, and all of our services are completely free of charge. We are experienced in helping people to manage the emotional, physical, and financial challenges that arise after a cancer diagnosis. One of the most important things to acknowledge about the emotional impact of cancer is that it can be felt as a loss. It can be a loss that manifests itself in many ways for both patients and caregivers. That's why it's so important to have an outlet to acknowledge how you're feeling and have someone you can talk to who will be supportive and understanding. This can mean talking one-on-one with a Cancer Care social worker or joining one of our support groups. Cancer Care offers face-to-face groups in our local offices in the New York area, as well as telephone and online groups. These groups offer an opportunity to talk with other people impacted by cancer, such as myelodysplastic syndrome, along with the help of a Cancer Care social worker to facilitate the group. Participating in a support group can be helpful simply by allowing you to talk with others who are in a similar situation and who truly understand in a way that no one else can. Group members offer encouragement and a real sense of community that can provide you with additional support and guidance. If you're interested in participating in a group, please call our Hope Line at 800-813-4673. Finally, myelodysplastic syndrome can have a significant impact on your finances, and for many of the people I talk to every day, this can be an overwhelming aspect. Cancer Care provides limited financial assistance to help with transportation to treatment or home care, child care, or pain medication. We can also connect you with other organizations for additional assistance to help you with the costs of cancer. So please contact us at 1-800-813-4673. Or go to our website at www.cancercare.org for more information about our oncology social work support.
Well, thank you very much, Maria. It's an excellent presentation, very a poignant presentation about the services that everyone can access from cancer care. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. We're going to ask Sam to bring all of our speakers on board, and Sam will explain to you how to queue up for questions, and we'll try to take as many of your questions as possible. If we do not get to your question in this period of time, you always can call Cancer Care at the end of the call at 1-800-813-HOPE, and again, I'll repeat that at the end of the call as well. But for now, let's try to see if we can take as many of your questions as possible, Sam, if you could explain to the audience how to queue up and ask questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Our first question comes from Allison S. Your line is now opened.
Thank you. My understanding, my brother has MDS, and my understanding is there's some new injection out for the platelets that has very serious side effects, and that nobody in his area is willing to recommend this. Are you familiar with that?
Perhaps I can jump in as we'll rotate with the answers and such. So there are two medicines that are improved, one injectable, one pill form, that are medicines approved for increasing the platelet count in individuals with a different blood disease, the blood disease that we call ITP or immune thrombocytopenia purpura, which basically is an isolated drop in the platelets related to the immune system destroying the platelets. It is a medicine that has not been approved in patients with mild dysplastic syndrome, but there have been some clinical trials that have been done. In the clinical trials, there have been some individuals with MDS who have had improvement in their platelets, but it's not yet approved for this indication. There are some potential side effects. There have been some bone marrow changes which have been observed that are still under investigation. So I would say at this point, it most accurately really falls as kind of an experimental use of the medication and is really not one that is widely available. Its safety, you know, for long-term use in MDS is something we just don't truly know enough about at this point. Gail or Elias, both of you have had experience with these. Any additional comments you would make?
No, I think you covered. I think you covered it exactly. The one comment that that I would make to the person who asked the question is that there are in some areas clinical trials still available with these or similar concept drugs that might be worth looking into.
I want to add one thing. We're having trial assessing these agents in combination with what Dr. Mesa has mentioned, decitabine or 5-azacitidine, especially in patients with low platelets. But outside clinical trials, these drugs are not available to be used in MDS.
And so could you comment, all of you, on the fact that this question of drugs that sometimes are technically in a clinical trial, but they're offered outside of the trial, and or does that happen, and what would be the recommendation in terms of best or most prudent care? Dr. Mesa, do you want to start with that?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, when a medicine is, you know, what is the access to medicines? There are medicines that are approved for the disease that we're speaking of, specifically MDS, and these medicines are both available and then typically covered by insurance, whether that be Medicare or someone's additional insurance. There may be a copay, but they should be covered. There are medicines which are available. Once a medication is approved for any reason, your physician technically can prescribe that medicine. But whether that is a safe or appropriate choice, if it's not approved, depends on really the experience with the drug and what is the information that's been published regarding its use in that disease. Now, the final piece is that if a drug is available, such as this medication, whether or not an insurance company would feel compelled to pay for a medication that's not approved, that becomes much, much more variable. You know, so there really are two issues. When you have the non-approved medicine, A, can you obtain it? You can probably obtain it. Two, should you use it? That becomes a much more complicated question. And third, will someone else agree to pay for it? That becomes very individualized.
I'd like to add one other comment to that answer, which is that for patients who are running low blood counts, there seems to be sometimes an assumption that we can perfectly target a therapy to the count that is low. So, for example, erythropoietin or something like Procrit or Aranesp is only for red cells, and G-CSF or something like Neupogen is only for white cells, and then other drugs like L-trombopag or Promacta is only for platelets. And I'd just like to caution everybody that the bone marrow environment isn't, it's an environment. All of these types of cells and their mommies and daddies that are creating them are swimming around together. And the effects of these agents are not restricted only to one lineage, which is why it's so important to carefully consider them and their use in patients with MDS where really the whole bone marrow is affected. And I think that that's why it's not as simple an answer to the question as we'd like it to be, because these the effects of the different medications may be more widespread in the bone marrow than just a very simple answer of bringing up a platelet count or bringing up a red cell count.
Could you say a bit more about that in terms of the impact, maybe more than just in the one area?
Well, I think that the way that cells grow up in the bone marrow, this gets to the concept of having what are called hematopoietic or blood-forming stem cells, and then there are also what are called progenitor cells. Now, these are big words, but basically what they mean is how the cells grow up in the bone marrow. How do they get there to begin with, and then how do they grow up to become the mature blood cells that are circulating around in the blood? Now, what happens for a lot of patients with myelodysplastic syndrome is that one or more of the cell lines is not being produced correctly. So that results in either anemia or thrombocytopenia or leukopenia, low white blood cells, or some combination. What I was trying to get at is to not assume that the medications that we have available are so specifically targeted that they are only designed to bring up the whatever lineage they are directed towards. So, for example, the drug in question about bringing up platelet counts, one of the reasons why it was not completely sure how to go forward using these drugs in MDS is because they may actually be affecting other parts of bone marrow production. And that's really a research question, but it's just trying to ease patients who are sometimes very frustrated that, well, if it just brings up your platelets, why can't I just use it? Aren't they being too strict? Shouldn't they just let me use it if it brings up the platelets? And the reason that I brought up the point that I did is just to emphasize the complexity of the bone marrow and the fact that these drugs may not only be acting in a highly restricted manner.
Excellent. Thank you very much for that explanation. Thank you. And Dr. Shabor, did you want to add anything as well?
No, just I agree with all what my colleagues have mentioned.
Okay, excellent. Okay. And our next question comes from one of our online participants, and this from Patricia, has severe bone pain. I am on Jakafi. Could this be a side effect of the medicine? Dr. Shabor, could you address that?
Well, I'll leave that for Dr. Mesa, who's the expert in myelofibrosis.
Okay. That's right, Dr. Mesa.
I would say that bone pain, myelofibrosis, for those with MDS, is basically a cousin of MDS. It is another bone marrow disease, and there are many individuals that can overlap between both. Jakafi is a JAK2 inhibitor, which is a medicine that helps block one of the steps involved with that disease and can help with a variety of the difficulties with the disease, enlargement of the spleen, symptoms, and other difficulties. In general, we've seen that bone pain can be a side effect of having the bone marrow illness, but we've not typically seen it as a side effect of that particular medication. So I would probably be more concerned that that's that's a sign of the disease as opposed to a side effect from the medication.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And now we have another question from another of our online participants, from Rob. And what relationships exist of MDS to AML, such as common risk factors and the sequencing of one to the other?
Okay. Shall I go ahead?
Yes, please.
You can go ahead, sure.
Okay. So, you know, again, I mentioned at the beginning, and we all mentioned, MDS is a spectrum of diseases that can include patients with a low risk to high risk. And the idea in a community, and which is wrong, that if you have MDS, it's going to evolve into AML. It's not true. Matter of fact, around 30 to 40% eventually will evolve into acute myeloid leukemia, while 60% to 70% will spend their life with MDS without evolving into acute leukemia. Now, we define acute leukemia as 20% in the blast, or above 20 or above more than 20% blast in a bone marrow that define acute myeloid leukemia, where MDS usually they have below 20%. Now, who are the patients that can evolve into AML? Are patients with MDS with a high blast percentage, like let's say above 5%, 10%, 15%, patients with bad karyotype, let's say they have chromosome 7 abnormal or multiple abnormalities, these patients are at high risk of evolving into acute myeloid leukemia. In contrast, patients with only anemia, with normal platelet count, have low blast in the bone marrow and merely having a normal karyotype, this patient is the opposite side, has a low risk of evolving into acute leukemia. So it's really important upfront when somebody is diagnosed with MDS to have a good scoring system to place the patient in the risk categories of evolving into AML or not, and therefore design treatment strategies based on these risk factors.
I would just make one additional comment to that. Which might have been part of the original question, that for patients who have had prior treatment with chemotherapy and or radiation therapy for something else, some other type of cancer, for example, that they might have had treatment for, part of the question seemed to be the risk for development of MDS and AML. And just in case that was part of the question, one of the areas that is a known risk factor for the development both for myelodysplastic syndrome and for acute myeloid leukemia would be prior therapy. And pathologically, actually, those types of bone marrow problems that happen after prior treatment are grouped together as what's called therapy-related diseases. So whether it's technically MDS or AML based on the blast count is actually less important than the fact that bone marrow problems which develop after other therapies are ones that need to be taken quite seriously and often behave in a leukemic manner, even if they don't technically meet the 20% blast criteria.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay, and we have another question from Grant. What processes are currently used to establish the environmental causes of MDS? And I know this is an issue that in our pre-conference had come up a lot, as a lot of people asked those questions. Dr. Messa, would you like to comment on that?
Sure. Well, it's a good question. You know, we know that in general, you know, there are a variety of injuries the bone marrow can undergo that can lead to the development of MDS and other bone marrow diseases. We know this can include chemotherapy. You know, chemotherapy that's life-saving for other diseases, such as lymphoma or other cancers. We know that this can be the case from radiation exposure, whether it be catastrophic radiation exposure, as was with particularly the survivors in Japan after the nuclear bombs, to some degree perhaps with some of the nuclear accidents such as Chernobyl, though probably to a lesser degree. We know that radiation from individuals who received therapeutic radiation clearly can be a factor as well. We know that various chemicals or other toxins clearly can be associated with it as well. Part of the challenge is that when we see patients with moderate dysplastic syndrome, there is not necessarily a fingerprint as to why the individual developed the disease. In fact, for many individuals, we think the biggest risk factor is really aging, and that as we age, there are genetic changes which can occur. So we ask the individual about their history, and we try to determine whether there seems a likely cause from the past or not. But there's a really tough way for us to prove that. So as we look at trying to elucidate environmental things, one, we don't think that all cases of MDS have an environmental cause. And two, it's difficult for us to sort out, you know, how much an individual environmental cause contribute. You know, so I know it's kind of a long-winded answer, but it truly is complex that if someone told me that they had an exposure, I could certainly say, yes, it may well have contributed, but it's really tough for me to know for certain. If I see a 70-year-old person who has MDS and had chemotherapy 10 years ago, might it be from their chemo? It might, but might they have developed MDS anyway? That's true as well.
Well, thank you. And I'm going to ask Ms. Chi if you would address this as well, because in all of our support groups, I know this question comes up a lot in terms of what caused this to happen. And do you want to just comment on how the group can help with that?
Sure, absolutely. excuse me, I can certainly understand the sense of frustration and anxiety that comes with not knowing exactly what may have caused any particular illness or your cancer. You know, that's a place where a group can really, really be helpful, just because other people are having these same concerns and they can really relate to that. You know, it certainly brings up a lot of confusion and uncertainty and sort of reviewing, you know, your life and history. So that's a place where other people can support you in that effort and help you figure out what's important to focus on in the moment and how can you sort of, you know, make sense of that, but then go on with your treatment and what you need to do every day to deal with it now.
Excellent. Thank you so much. We have another question, actually, from one of our online participants who've really been very active today, and we appreciate that very much, their questions. This is from Ian, and the question is, do you recommend a special diet for MDS patients and for those on cyclosporin? Dr. Jabbour, do you want to address that?
Yes. A special diet, no, I do not recommend special diet for MDS patients. Now, that being said, I will be cautious if you're traveling somewhere, some areas where you have endemic or infectious known, I will be very careful. I'll be very careful when you eat raw food, oysters, sushis, and other stuff, but that these are general recommendations, not specifically for MDS. Second, regarding cyclosporin, it's being given for patients with aplastic anemia or MDS with hypoplastic features. So you have to be careful with the kidney dysfunction. We have to monitor carefully for the creatinine level. So therefore, you have to increase the fluid intake. Be aware of the side effects of the drug as well. Tremor, hypomagnesemia, these need to be checked, and the blood pressure as well. So these are the common measures that you need to be aware of them when you're on cyclosporin. And the diet I mentioned, I don't have specific recommendations.
And I just another general question in terms of just the whole issue of immunizations and things like that, because we are entering in some parts of the country into a time of year when people are getting flu shots and things like that. And can you just collectively comment on these type of immunizations for people, or when they travel, if there are some particular things that people living with MDS should be aware of?
Well, for the flu shot in America, in our institution, we recommend the flu shot for patients not getting chemotherapy with ANC below 1,000. We do recommend the flu shot. Otherwise, for the traveling, it would be case per case.
Yeah, we also do recommend the flu shots for our MDS patients. I think the travel recommendations are based on the location of the destination of the travel, and those are usually following the guidelines from the International Medicine Group. And then I would just make one other quick observation about diet. While I also do not recommend a specific diet, I have noticed that a lot of people do make assumptions that, for example, eating a lot of iron will be helpful if you have anemia, and they try to eat foods with lots of iron in them. or getting B12 injections will help with your energy or anemia, and these types of nutritional supplements can actually be the absolutely wrong thing to do. In general, if you're not deficient in these, there would be no reason to take excess quantities. And in fact, patients with MDS who become increasingly transfusion dependent sometimes have to worry about iron overload, let alone iron deficiency. So I would just caution patients not to assume that the general measures out there, sort of on the cereal boxes and so forth, that what's good for anemia in general nutritionally may not specifically be good for your anemia.
Perhaps I might add, and I think Gail raises a special point, that a lot of the supplements as well that say they're quote-unquote good for anemia basically try to give more B12 and more iron. I mean, those nutritional deficiencies are common causes of anemia, but they're very different causes of anemia than myelodysplastic syndrome. Basically, these are individuals that don't have sufficient building blocks for their cells, where in MDS, this is not the problem. People with MDS typically have enough building blocks of cells. The problem is the machinery that makes the cells is really not working. So, in fact, you tend to have more iron than you wish, you know, and B12 is, you know, needs to be checked, but is usually not a big issue. So getting more of those things is not helpful, and as Gail says, may even be harmful.
Thank you. We have a complex question from one of our online participants, actually, from Dawn, and I'm going to try to kind of summarize it. The question really is to Dr. Robos. Are there any investigational drugs that you are aware of that a patient in a life-threatening situation might have access to at this time under this rule? And I'll go over what the rule is. And given the typical severity of AML state, if there are drugs available, how likely is a patient to be successful in obtaining treatment given the complexity of the system? And I think the person is calling on behalf of someone else. And the system they're referring to is according to 21 CFR Part 312, expanded access to investigational drugs for treatment use, that access to experimental drugs is possible.
It's definitely a it sounds like a complex issue which needs to be handled individually, but let me make a couple of points. So there are, in general, there are sometimes investigational drugs which are far along in development and look significantly promising, for which it is possible to get a compassionate access to the drug via an application to the FDA and to the company that manufactures the drug, even if a patient isn't necessarily on a clinical trial, or perhaps the clinical trials are no longer open but the drug isn't approved yet. So that definitely does exist. I can tell you at the moment for acute myeloid leukemia, I wish there would be something which would be so wonderful that we would be rushing for expanded access to it. There isn't anything at the moment which is imminently important in terms of curing AML that I could imagine necessarily what the compassionate application would be for, because while there are clinical trials going on, and we're obviously very hopeful that some of them will represent an incremental improvement, there isn't anything at the moment which is so near or so clearly superior to other things for acute myeloid leukemia that it would be easy for me to see where the reader was going with the compassionate application. But there are, in fact, other scenarios in which drugs are sort of in between finishing out their last clinical trials and approval, for which there are definitely compassionate applications, and we do that, and other academic centers and physicians will do that, and generally the turnaround time, although there is a lot of paperwork, the turnaround time is quick because clearly those are patients in dire situations. I don't know if either of my colleagues has anything to add to that.
Yeah, but I think you summarized it well. The short answer is that it is still very difficult to obtain such a medicine through compassionate use. It is it is conceivable, but there's got to both be kind of an overwhelming reason. And typically, this occurs, you know, in the window of time between when a drug has been shown to be overwhelmingly beneficial and is getting close to being FDA approved, but is not quite there yet. So it's typically not something really at an early phase, but it's typically is kind of a gap measure between the end of a clearly positive clinical trial and an FDA approval, so that the FDA could say, we know it's a beneficial drug, we got to dot the I's and cross the T's, but we don't want to deny patients access to the therapy in this window before we give our final stamp of blessing.
Well, thank you very much. I want to thank all of our speakers. You've really been outstanding today. I want to thank all of you, really our online participants, our telephone participants, asking such great questions. Please remember that we don't want anyone to leave the call feeling that you're alone. You can contact Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE. We are simply a telephone call away, and please keep that in mind. I want to wish you all a very fine day, and thank you all for participating.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect. Everyone, have a wonderful day.